Introduction. Is it possible to live without relying psychologically on authority, either on external authority or even on the authority of one's own past experience? For Jiddu Krishnamurti, that, suitably qualified, is the key question. His answer is that it is possible, and that only in this way can one connect fully with what is real. Krishnamurti was not a philosopher in the classical sense. He wasn't interested in presenting theories or in arguing for his views. Still, what he was up to is continuous with philosophy. Like Socrates, who through his example and questioning encourages his audiences to examine critically the assumptions on which their beliefs depend, Krishnamurti, through his example and questioning, encourages his audiences to examine critically the assumptions on which their very experience of themselves and the world depends. In other words, whereas Socrates encourages what today we would call critical thinking, or simply philosophy, Krishnamurti encourages what we might call critical looking, and what he sometimes called choiceless awareness. What Socrates asked the Athenians to do is by now commonplace, at least to philosophers and to students of philosophy. We have learned the lesson he was trying to teach. But to his original audience, the Athenians, what he was asking them to do often must have seemed strange and even pointless. What good could possibly come, many of them must have wondered, from giving the axe to conventional wisdom? Why, they must have asked, should we start freshly when we have accumulated so much? But the distorting weight of what you have accumulated, Socrates tried to point out, is precisely the problem. At the time Socrates proposed critical thinking, there was not much reason for the Athenians to suppose it would bear fruit. But it did. Science is part of that fruit. So is the modern disposition to question the authority of received views. Have we learned all we need to know about questioning authority? Have we gone far enough? Or is our questioning still seriously limited? Contemporary philosophers and students of philosophy tend to think that we have carried the questioning process about as far as it can go. Many even think we have taken it too far. But up to this point, we have questioned mainly only explicit beliefs. In addition to these beliefs, might we not still take a great deal that is questionable for granted? And if we do, couldn't this also be an obstacle we need to overcome? Krishnamurti thought that in our doubting, we have not gone far enough. He thought that our questioning is seriously limited, and that this is a major obstacle we need to overcome. Could he be right? Krishnamurti was not the first to propose critical looking. Others, such as the Buddha, had already proposed it. But Krishnamurti's approach was different, and perhaps better suited to skeptically minded philosophers and students of philosophy. For one thing, Krishnamurti was anti-authority to a degree that few thinkers have ever been. He had no use for creeds or theories. He discouraged people from examining themselves in an institutional setting or as part of a spiritual discipline. He taught that in examining oneself, one should not rely even on what one has learned in previous examinations. The freedom we need to see what is true, he said, is freedom from the known. And because he spoke to us in a contemporary idiom, it may be easier for us to understand what he said. Krishnamurti had little use for academic philosophy. Occasionally, he dismissed it as a waste of time, or worse, as a generator of theories that become obstacles in an individual's attempt to understand him or herself. Yet, as the writings in this volume will reveal to those who accept his invitation to examine their experience and behavior, much of what Krishnamurti said is deeply relevant to philosophy. Its relevance is not that he had theories to propose or critiques of extant theories. Krishnamurti's focus is on insights. His talent as a teacher is that he facilitates them. As it happens, many of the insights he helps his readers to have are centrally relevant to contemporary philosophy, particularly to theories about human subjectivity and values. And if indeed he does facilitate insights about the human condition, how could it be otherwise? Rather than a theorist, Krishnamurti was a seer and a teacher. Among the things he thought he saw are certain inherently distorting psychological structures that bring about a division in almost everyone's consciousness between the observer and the observed. This division, he believed, is a potent source of conflict, both internally for the individual and through the individual externalized for society as a whole. Krishnamurti also proposed a way to remove these damaging structures, or, more accurately, to facilitate their removal. That is what the writings in this volume are about, a radical transformation in human consciousness. Krishnamurti talked a great deal more than he wrote. His talks, from which almost all of the following selections are taken, were not lectures, but rather attempts to engage his audience in a dialogue in which he and they are wholly focused on the same aspect of experience or behavior. His talks were, in effect, guided meditations. That is, they were attempts by Krishnamurti to go through an experiential process with his audiences, with you, the result of which is that something about your understanding of your own experience and its effect on your behavior is clarified. As such, his talks, here transcribed and edited as if they were writings, make unusual demands on the reader, especially if the reader is a philosopher who is accustomed to looking for a theoretical punchline when reading something that seems to put forth philosophical views. In Krishnamurti's thought, rather than theoretical punchlines, there is an opening to important insights, for instance, about the nature of identification and its role in the formation of the self. To have such insights, Krishnamurti suggests, one has to look freshly. Krishnamurti spoke with a distinctive voice. As an uncompromising enemy of authority, even of the authority of one's own past experience, his focus was on examining current experience directly. Refusing to discuss books or theories, he encouraged people to look at themselves, particularly in their relationships to other people, things, and activities. And he told them just enough about what he thought they would see, if they did look, to get them going. It is as if through the habit of understanding ourselves in familiar ways, we are, even at the level of experience, stuck in theories. Krishnamurti is, extremely good at helping people get unstuck. That is, at helping them to have insights that break the molds of deeply ingrained patterns of thinking. In other words, his concern was not that his remarks be relevant to theory, although often they are, but that they be relevant to life. His intention was to engage with people who are passionately interested in understanding themselves and the world in which they live. The point of this engagement was to clarify what it means to be oneself and to live in this world. In my opinion, Krishnamurti succeeds in this as few others have. Philosophers and students of philosophy are surely among those who are passionately interested in understanding themselves and the world. Many of us have devoted much of our lives to this project. We may be surprised, then, to discover how little time and energy we have spent in the sort of inquiry Krishnamurti tried to facilitate. The reason for this is that Krishnamurti's approach to topics of perennial philosophical interest was more meditative than rationally discursive. So the question for philosophers and students of philosophy in considering how seriously they should take this book is whether they're willing to try an approach that's philosophical in a broad sense, but so different from what they're accustomed to doing when they think about or read philosophy that it may be difficult at first for them even to see its relevance. True philosophers are always open to new approaches. Indeed, when an approach has promise, the more radically new it is, the better. This volume is primarily for them. By almost any standards, Krishnamurti led a remarkable life. He was born on May 11, 1895, in Madanapally, India, a small hill town northwest of Madras, the 8th of 11 children, and one of 6 to survive into adulthood. His father, a graduate of Madras University, worked for the British Department of Revenue. His mother ran a traditional Brahmin home. At the age of 6, Krishnamurti was ritually initiated into Brahminhood and began his formal education. He was not a good student. When Krishnamurti was 10 years old, his mother died. 4 years later, in 1909, his father, now retired from the British administration, secured a job at the headquarters of the Theosophical Society in Adyar, near Madras. In exchange for work, he and 4 of his sons, including Krishnamurti and his younger brother, Nityanand, Nitya, were given accommodation in a cottage outside the beautiful 260-acre Theosophical Society compound. At the time, all of the children were in poor physical condition. The Theosophical Society had been founded in New York 34 years earlier by Madame Blavatsky and Colonel Olcott. Blavatsky claimed to have lived in Tibet and learned occult wisdom from the masters. Supposedly, the masters were perfected human beings who periodically appeared on Earth to found a new religion and, through their thoughts and energy, to direct the course of human evolution. In 1882, Blavatsky and Olcott had purchased the estate at Adyar for the society's headquarters. 7 years later, Annie Besant joined the society, and a year later she met Charles Ledbetter, a former priest in the Church of England who had joined the society in 1883. Ledbetter was considered to be remarkably psychic. Among other talents, he supposedly saw auras and engaged in astral travel. In 1907, after the deaths of Blavatsky and Olcott, and 2 years prior to Krishnamurti's arrival at the compound, Besant became president of the society. Central to Theosophy is the teaching that humans are progressively evolving toward universal brotherhood on a path that traverses the sequential appearance of 7 root races. At the origin of each of these races, a world teacher incarnates to impart a spiritual message. The next teacher due to appear was Maitreya, who was thought to be designated for that role by Gautama Buddha. The Theosophist's mission was, in part, to find, raise, and train the child destined to become Maitreya. In the early summer of 1909, while walking outside the compound, Ledbetter spotted Krishnamurti, who was then 14 years old. Reportedly overwhelmed by what he took to be Krishnamurti's aura, Ledbetter was sure that Krishnamurti was destined to be a great spiritual teacher. Eventually, the Theosophists determined to their own satisfaction that Krishnamurti was to be the physical vehicle for Maitreya. So Krishnamurti and his brother Nitya were brought into the compound, deloused, groomed, and otherwise attended to physically. Krishnamurti's teeth were even straightened. He and Nitya were privately tutored. Eventually, Mrs. Besant became Krishnamurti's legal guardian. In 1911, an organization was formed that became the Order of the Star in the East. Its purpose was to herald the arrival of the new world teacher, Krishnamurti. For the next 10 years, Krishnamurti and Nitya were educated in Europe. While in England, Krishnamurti became close to Lady Emily Lutyens, whom he regarded as his foster mother, and through whom he was introduced to the life of English aristocracy. He exercised at Sandow's Gymnasium, attended ballet, film, theater, visited art galleries, and traveled extensively. During this period, he became a scratch golfer and learned how to assemble and reassemble an automobile engine. He also read widely, among other authors, Stephen Leacock, P.G. Woodhouse, Turgenev, Dostoevsky, Nietzsche, Bergson, Shelley, and Keats. In 1921, Krishnamurti went to Paris, where he took courses at the Sorbonne and studied Sanskrit. In 1922, Krishnamurti and Nitya moved to Ojai, California, where it was hoped the dry climate would help Nitya in his battle with tuberculosis. During the summer of that year, shortly after he began to meditate daily, Krishnamurti had a life-transforming experience, which he described in part as follows. There was a man mending the road. That man was myself. The pickaxe he held was myself. The very stone which he was breaking up was a part of me. The tender blade of grass was my very being, and the tree beside the man was myself. The next day, while sitting under a nearby pepper tree, he had additional experiences, after which he wrote, "I was supremely happy, for I had seen. Nothing could ever be the same. I had touched compassion, which heals all sorrow and suffering. It is not for myself, but for the world. I have stood on the mountaintop and gazed at the mighty beings. Never can I be in utter darkness. I have seen the glorious and healing light. The fountain of truth has been revealed to me, and the darkness has been dispersed. Love, in all its glory, has intoxicated my heart. My heart can never be closed. I have drunk at the fountain of joy and eternal beauty." Krishnamurti described himself as God-intoxicated. In November of 1925, Nitya died, and Krishnamurti experienced what seems to have been the profoundest grief of his life. During the next few years, Krishnamurti distanced himself from theosophy and also developed some of the distinctive motifs of his own subsequent teachings. The decisive break with theosophy came in August of 1929, when, in the presence of 3,000 members of the society, he dissolved the Order of the Star, and in the process, staked out his own mission. "I maintain that truth is a pathless land, and you cannot approach it by any path whatsoever, by any religion, by any sect. That is my point of view, and I adhere to that absolutely and unconditionally. Truth, being limitless, unconditioned, unapproachable by any path whatsoever, cannot be organized, nor should any organization be formed to lead or coerce people along any particular path. You will probably form other orders. You will continue to belong to other organizations, searching for truth. If an organization be created for this purpose, it becomes a crutch, a weakness, a bondage, and must cripple the individual and prevent him from growing, from establishing his uniqueness, which lies in the discovery, for himself, of that absolute, unconditioned truth. Because I am free, unconditioned, whole, not the part, not the relative, but the whole truth that is eternal, I desire those who seek to understand me, to be free, not to follow me, not to make out of me a cage which will become a religion, a sect. I have now decided to disband the order, as I happen to be its head. You can form other organizations and expect someone else. With that I am not concerned, nor with creating new cages, new decorations for those cages. My only concern is to set men absolutely, unconditionally, free. The next year, in 1930, Krishnamurti formally resigned from the Theosophical Society. In 1931, Krishnamurti returned to Ojai to rest, meditate, and think. During this time, he wrote to Lady Emily of the difficulty of putting what he wanted to say into words. However, once he did start again to write and speak, he was remarkably consistent. From 1933 to 1939, Krishnamurti traveled extensively, talking to large audiences. During the war, he was unable to travel and led a life of relative seclusion at Ojai, although he still met with many visitors. He became close friends with Aldous Huxley, who encouraged him to write. After the war, Krishnamurti resumed his traveling and talking. During the last 40 years of his life, he gave, on average, about 100 talks a year, often to audiences of several thousand people. He also engaged in personal and small group discussions with those who came to see him. On one light-hearted occasion during this period, he went on a picnic in California with Bertrand Russell, Charlie Chaplin, Greta Garbo, Aldous Huxley, and Christopher Isherwood. A local sheriff evicted them from their chosen picnic site, not believing them to be who they said they were. In 1953, Krishnamurti wrote Education and the Significance of Life, followed in 1954 by The First and Last Freedom, which included a foreword by Huxley. Then there appeared three volumes entitled Commentaries on Living. He also wrote Krishnamurti's Notebook, a personal journal, mostly from 1961, Krishnamurti's journal from writings he had done in 1973 and 1975, two volumes of letters to the schools started in his name, and Krishnamurti to himself, his last audio-taped journal in 1983. The remainder of Krishnamurti's books, the number is now over 100 and still growing, are edited transcriptions of talks and discussions held by him in various parts of the world. The discussants are mostly everyday people, but often also include well-known people, such as the Nobel laureates Maurice Wilkins and Jonas Salk, theoretical physicist David Bohm, and the Buddhist scholar Walpola Rahula. Videotapes of many of these discussions are available. Excerpts from these videotapes are included in several films that have been made about Krishnamurti, including Krishnamurti, The Challenge of Change, and The Seer Who Walks Alone. In addition, Krishnamurti's talks and public discussions from 1933 to 1986 are available on CD-ROM. On February 17, 1986, in Ojai, California, at the age of 90, Krishnamurti died of pancreatic cancer. Raymond Martin, University of Maryland.